and tell me of your land, your home and city, that thither our ships may bear you with a discerning aim. For on Phaeacian ships there are no pilots, nor are there rudders such as other vessels carry. But the ships understand the will and mind of man. They know the cities and rich lands of every nation, and swiftly they cross the sea gulf, shrouded in mist and cloud. On them there is no fear of being harmed or lost. Still, this is what I heard Nausithous, my father, tell. He said Poseidon was displeased because we were safe guides for all mankind, and he averred the god one day would wreck a staunch ship of the Phaeacians, returning home from pilotage upon the misty sea, and then would throw a lofty mound about our city. That was the old man's story, and this god may fulfill, or else it may go unfulfilled as pleases him. But now declare this, and plainly tell, where you have wandered, and what countries you have seen. About the men and stately towns, too, let me hear. What ones were fierce and savage, with no regard for right? What ones were kind to strangers and reverent toward the gods? And tell me why you weep and grieve within your breast, on hearing of the lot of Argive Danaans of Ilius. This the gods wrought. They spun the thread of death for some, that others in the time to come might have a song. Had you some relative who fell at Ilius? One who was dear? Some daughter's husband or wife's father? They who stand closest to us after our flesh and blood? Or was it possibly some friend who pleased you well, a gallant comrade? For a friend with an understanding heart is worth no less than a brother. Book 9. The Story Told to Alcinous. The Cyclops. Then wise Odysseus answered him and said, "Mighty Alcinous, renowned of all, surely it is a pleasant thing to hear a bard like this, one who is even like the gods in voice. For happier occasion, I think there cannot be than when good cheer possesses a whole people, and feasting through the houses, they listen to a bard seated in proper order, while beside them stand the tables supplied with bread and meat, and dipping wine from out the mixer, the pourer bears it round and fills the cups. That is a sight most pleasing. But your heart bids you learn my grievous woes, and so to make me weep and sorrow more. What shall I tell you first, then, and what last? For many are the woes the gods of heaven have given me. First I will tell my name, that you, like all, may know it. And I, accordingly, seeking deliverance from my day of doom, may be your guest friend, though my home is far away. I am Odysseus, son of Laertes, who for all craft am noted among men, and my renown reaches to heaven. My home is Ithaca, a land far seen, for on it is the lofty height of Neriton, covered with waving woods. Around lie many islands, very close to one another, Dulichion, Sema, and woody Zacynthus. Ithaca itself lies low along the sea, far to the west, the others stretching eastward toward the dawn. A rugged land, and yet a kindly nurse. A sweeter spot than my own land I shall not see. Calypso, a heavenly goddess, sought to keep me by her side within her hollow grotto, desiring me to be her husband. So too Aeaean Circe, full of craft, detained me in her palace, desiring me to be her husband. But they never beguiled the heart within my breast. Nothing more sweet than home and parents can there be, however rich one's dwelling far in a foreign land, cut off from parents. But let me tell you of the grievous journey home which Zeus ordained me on my setting forth from Troy. The wind took me from Ilius and bore me to the Ciconians, to Ismarus. There I destroyed the town and slew its men. But from the town we took the women and great stores of treasure, and parted all, that none might go lacking his proper share. This done, I warned our men swiftly to fly. But they, in utter folly, did not heed. Much wine was drunk, and they slaughtered on the shore a multitude of sheep and swing-paced, crook-horned oxen. Meanwhile, escaped Ciconians began to call for aid on those Ciconians who were their neighbors, and more numerous and brave than they, a people dwelling inland, skillful at fighting in chariot or on foot as need might be. Accordingly, at dawn they gathered, thick as leaves and flowers appear in spring. And now an evil fate from Zeus beset our luckless men, causing us many sorrows. For setting the battle in array by the swift ships, all fought and hurled their brazen spears at one another. While it was morning and the day grew stronger, we steadily kept them off and held our ground, though they were more than we. But as the sun declined toward stalling time, then the Ciconians turned our men and routed the Achaeans. 6 of the crew of every ship fell in their harness there. The rest fled death and doom. Thence we sailed on with aching hearts, glad to be clear of death, though missing our dear comrades. Yet the curved ships did not pass on till we had called 3 times to each poor comrade who died upon the plain, cut off by the Ciconians. But now cloud-gathering Zeus sent the north wind against our ships in a fierce tempest, and covered with his clouds both land and sea. Night broke from heaven. The ships drove headlong onward, their sails torn into tatters by the furious wind. These sails we lowered in terror for our lives, and rowed the ships themselves hurriedly toward the land. There for 2 nights and days continuously we lay, gnawing our hearts because of toil and trouble. But when the fair-haired dawn brought the 3rd day, we set our masts, and hoisting the white sails, we sat us down, while wind and helmsman kept us steady. And now I should have come unharmed to my own land, but that the swell and current, in doubling Melia, and northern winds turned me aside, and drove me past Cythera. Thence for 9 days I drifted before the deadly blasts along the swarming sea, but on the 10th we touched the land of lotus-eaters, men who make food of flowers. So here we went ashore and drew us water, and soon by the swift ships my men prepared their dinner. Then after we had tasted food and drink, I sent some sailors forth to go and learn what men who live by bread dwelt in the land, selecting 2 and joining with them a herald as a 3rd. These, straightway, went and mingled with the lotus-eaters. These lotus-eaters had no thought of harm against our men. Indeed, they gave them lotus to taste. But whosoever of them ate the lotus-honey fruit wished to bring tidings back no more, and never to leave the place. But with the lotus-eaters their desire to stay, to feed on lotus and forget his going home. These men I brought back weeping to the ships by very force, and dragging them under the benches of our hollow ships, I bound them fast, and bade my other trusty men to hasten and embark on the swift ships, that none of them might eat the lotus and forget his going home. Quickly they came aboard, took places at the pins, and sitting in order smote the foaming water with their oars. Thence we sailed on with aching hearts, and came to the land of the Cyclops, a rude and lawless folk, who, trusting to the immortal gods, plant with their hands no plant, nor ever plough, but all things spring unsown and without ploughing, wheat, barley, and grapes with wine in their heavy clusters, for rain from Zeus makes the grape grow. Among this people no assemblies meet, they have no stable laws. They live on the tops of lofty hills in hollow caves. Each gives the law to his own wife and children, and cares for no one else. Now, a rough island stretches along outside the harbor, not close to the Cyclops' coast nor yet far out, covered with trees. On it, innumerable wild goats breed. No tread of man disturbs them. None comes here to follow hounds, to toil through woods and climb the crests of hills. The island is not held for flocks or tillage, but all unsown, untilled, it evermore is bare of men and feeds the bleating goats. Among the Cyclops are no red-cheeked ships, nor are there shipwrights who might build the well-benched ships to do them service, sailing to foreign towns, as men are wont to cross the sea in ships to one another. With ships they might have worked the well-placed island, for it is not at all a worthless spot, but would bear all things duly. For here are meadows on the banks of the grey sea, moist with soft soil. Here vines could never die. Here is smooth ploughing land, a very heavy crop, and always well in season might be reaped, for the undersoil is rich. Here is a quiet harbour, never needing moorings, throwing out anchor stones or fastening cables, but merely to run in and wait a while till sailor hearts are ready and the winds are blowing. Just at the harbour's head, a spring of sparkling water flows from beneath a cave. Around it poplars grow. Here we sailed in, some god our guide, through murky night. There was no light to see, for round the ships was a dense fog. No moon looked out from heaven. It was shut in with clouds, so no one saw the island. And the long waves rolling on the shore we did not see until we beached our well-benched ships. After the ships were beached, we lowered all our sails, and forth we went ourselves upon the shore, where, falling fast asleep, we awaited sacred dawn. But when the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, in wonder at the island we made a circuit round it, and nymphs, daughters of aegis-bearing Zeus, started the mountain goats to give my men a meal. Forthwith we took our bending bows and our long hunting spears from out the ships, and, parted in three bands, began to shoot. And soon God granted ample game. 12 ships were in my train. To each there fell 9 goats, while 10 they set apart for me alone. Then all throughout the day, till setting sun, we sat and feasted on abundant meat and pleasant wine. For the ruddy wine of our ships was not yet spent. Some still was left, because our crews took a large store in jars the day we seized the sacred citadel of the Ciconians. And now we looked across the land of the neighboring Cyclops, and marked the smoke, the sounds of men, the bleat of sheep and goats. But when the sun went down and darkness came, we laid us down to sleep upon the beach. Then, as the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, holding a council, I said to all my men, "The rest of you, my trusty crews, stay for the present here. But I myself, with my own ship and my own crew, go to discover who these men may be, if they're fierce and savage, with no regard for right, or kind to strangers and reverent toward the gods." When I had spoken thus, I went on board my ship and called my crew to come on board and loose the cables. Quickly they came, took places at the pins, and sitting in order smote the foaming water with their oars. But when we reached the neighboring shore, there at the outer point, close to the sea, we found a cave high, overhung with laurel. Here many flocks of sheep and goats were nightly housed. Around was built a yard with a high wall of deep embedded stone, tall pines and crested oaks. Here a man-monster slept, who shepherded his flock alone and far apart. With others he did not mingle, but quite aloof followed his lawless ways. Thus had he grown to be a marvelous monster, not like a man who lives by bread, but rather like a woody peak of the high hills, seen single, clear of others. Now to my other trusty men I gave command to stay there by the ship and guard the ship. But I myself chose the 12 best among my men and sallied forth. I had a goat-skin bottle of the dark sweet wine, given me by Meron, son of Evanthes, priest of Apollo, who watches over Ismaris. He gave me this because we guarded him and his son and wife through holy fear, for he dwelt within the shady grove of Phoebus Apollo. He brought me splendid gifts. Of fine wrought gold he gave me 7 talents, gave me a mixing bowl of solid silver, and afterwards filled me 12 jars with wine, sweet and unmixed, a drink for gods. None knew that wine among the slaves and handmaids of his house, none but himself, his own dear wife, and one sole housedame. Whenever they drank the honeyed ruddy wine, he filled a cup and poured it into 20 parts of water, and still from the bowl came a sweet odor of a surprising strength. Then, to refrain had been no easy matter. I filled a large skin full of this, and took it with me, and also took provision in a sack. For my stout heart suspected I should soon meet a man arrayed in mighty power, a savage, ignorant of rights and laws. Quickly we reached the cave, but did not find him there, for he was tending his fat flock afield. Entering the cave, we looked around. Here crates were standing, loaded down with cheese, and here pens thronged with lambs and kids. In separate pens, each sort was folded, by themselves the older, by themselves the later born, and by themselves the younglings. Swimming with whey were all the vessels, the well-wrought pails and bowls in which he milked. Here my men pressed me strongly to take some cheeses and go back. Then, later, driving the kids and lambs to our swift ship out of the pens to sail away over the briny water. But I refused. Far better had I yielded, hoping that I might see him and he might offer gifts. But he was to prove, when seen, no pleasure to my men. Kindling a fire here, we made burnt offering, and we ourselves took of the cheese and ate. And so we sat and waited in the cave until he came from pasture. He brought a ponderous burden of dry wood to use at supper time, and tossing it down inside the cave raised a great din. We hurried off in terror to a corner of the cave. But into the wide-mouthed cave he drove his sturdy flock, all that he milked. The males, both rams and goats, he left outside in the high yard. And now he set in place the huge door-stone, lifting it high in the air, a ponderous thing. No 22 carts, staunch and four-wheeled, could start it from the ground. Such was the rugged rock he set against the door. Then, sitting down, he milked the ewes and bleating goats all in due order, and underneath put each one's young. Straightway he curdled half the white milk, and gathering it in wicker baskets, set it by. Half he left standing in the pails, ready for him to take and drink, and have it for his supper. So after he had busily performed his tasks, he kindled a fire, noticed us, and asked,
"Ah, strangers, who are you? Where do you come from, sailing the watery ways? Are you upon some business, or do you rove at random as the pirates roam the seas, risking their lives and bringing ill to strangers?"
As thus he spoke, our very souls were crushed within us, dismayed by the heavy voice and by the monster's self. Nevertheless, I answered thus, and said, "We are from Troy, Achaeans, driven by shifting winds out of our course across the great gulf of the sea. Homeward we fared, but through strange ways and wanderings are come hither. So Zeus was pleased to purpose. Subjects of Agamemnon, son of Atreus, we boast ourselves to be, whose fame is now the widest under heaven. So great a town he sacked, so many people slew. But chancing here, we come before your knees to ask that you will offer hospitality, and in other ways as well will give the gift which is the stranger's due. O mighty one, respect the gods. We are your suppliants, and Zeus is the avenger of the suppliant and the stranger. He is the stranger's friend, attending the deserving." So I spoke. And from a ruthless heart he straightway answered, "You are simple, stranger, or come from far away to bid me dread the gods or shrink before them. The Cyclops pay no heed to aegis-bearing Zeus, nor to the blessed gods, because we are much stronger than themselves. To shun the wrath of Zeus I would not spare you or your comrades, did my heart not bid. But tell me where you left your staunch ship at your coming."
"At the far shore, or near? Let me but know."
He thought to tempt me, but he could not cheat a knowing man like me, and I again replied with words of guile. "The earth-shaker, Poseidon, wrecked my ship and cast her on the rocks at the Land's End, drifting her on a headland. The wind blew from the sea, and I with these men here escaped from utter ruin." So I spoke, and from a ruthless heart he answered nothing, but starting up laid hands on my companions. He seized on two and dashed them to the ground as if they had been dogs. Their brains ran out upon the floor and wet the earth. Tearing them limb from limb, he made his supper, and ate as does a mountain lion, leaving nothing, entrails or flesh or marrow bones.
We, in our tears, held up our hands to Zeus at sight of his cruel deeds. Helplessness held our hearts. But when the Cyclops had filled his monstrous maw by eating human flesh and pouring down pure milk, he laid himself in the cave full length among his flock. And I then formed the plan within my daring heart of closing on him, drawing my sharp sword from my thigh and stabbing him in the breast where the midriff holds the liver, feeling the place out with my hand. Yet second thoughts restrained me, for then we too had met with utter ruin, for we could never with our hands have pushed from the tall door the enormous stone which he'd sent against it. Thus, then, with sighs, we awaited sacred dawn. But when the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, he kindled a fire, milked his goodly flock, all in due order, and underneath put each one's young. Then, after he had busily performed his tasks, seizing once more two men, he made his morning meal. And when the meal was ended, he drove from the cave his sturdy flock, and easily moved the huge doorstone, but afterwards put it back as one might put the lid upon a quiver. Then to the hills with many a call he steered his sturdy flock, while I was left behind, brooding on evil, and thinking how I might have vengeance, would but Athena grant my prayer. And to my mind this seemed the wisest way. There lay beside the pen a great club of the Cyclops, an olive stick still green, which he had cut to be his staff when dried. Inspecting it, we guessed its size, and thought it like the mast of a black ship of 20 oars, some broad-built merchantman which sails the great gulf of the sea. So huge it looked in length and thickness. I went and cut away a fathom's length of this, laid it before my men, and bade them shape it down. They made it smooth. I then stood by to point the tip, and laying hold, I charred it briskly in the blazing fire. The piece I now put carefully away, hiding it in the dung which lay about the cave in great abundance, and then I bade my comrades fix by lot who the bold men should be to help me raise the stake and grind it in his eye when pleasant sleep should come. These drew the lot whom I myself would fain have chosen. Four were they, for a fifth I counted in myself. He came toward evening, shepherding the fleecy flock, and forthwith drove his sturdy flock into the wide-mouthed cave, all with much care. He did not leave a sheep in the high yard outside, either through some suspicion, or God bade him so to do. Again he set in place the huge doorstone, lifting it high in air, and sitting down he milked the ewes and bleating goats, all in due order, and underneath put each one's young. Then, after he had busily performed his tasks, he seized once more two men and made his supper. And now it was that, drawing near the Cyclops, I thus spoke, holding within my hands an ivy bowl filled with dark wine. "Here, Cyclops, drink some wine after your meal of human flesh, and see what sort of liquor our ship held. I brought it as an offering, thinking that you might pity me and send me home. But you're mad past bearing, reckless. How should a stranger come to you again from any people when you do not act with decency?" So I spoke. He took the cup and drank it off, and mightily pleased he was with the taste of the sweet liquor, and thus he asked me for it yet again. "Give me some more, kind sir, and straightway tell your name, that I may give a stranger's gift with which you shall be pleased. Ah, yes, the Cyclops' fruitful fields bear wine in their heavy clusters, for rain from Zeus makes the grape grow. But this is a bit of ambrosia, nectar." So he spoke, and I again offered the sparkling wine. Three times I brought and gave. Three times he drank it in his folly. Then, as the wine began to dull the Cyclops' senses, in winning words I said to him, "Cyclops, you ask my noble name, and I will tell it. But do you give the stranger's gift just as you promised? My name is No Man. No Man I am called, by mother, father, and by all my comrades." So I spoke, and from a ruthless heart he straightway answered,
No man I eat up last, after his comrades. All the rest first, and that shall be the stranger's gift for you." He spoke, and sinking back fell flat, and there he lay, lolling his thick neck over, till sleep that conquers all took hold upon him. Out of his throat poured wine and scraps of human flesh. Heavy with wine he spewed it forth. And now it was, I drove the stake under a heap of ashes to bring it to a heat, and with my words emboldened all my men that none might flinch through fear. Then when the olive stake, green though it was ready to take fire, and through was all aglow, I snatched it from the fire, while my men stood around, and heaven inspired us with great courage. Seizing the olive stake, sharp at the tip, they plunged it in his eye, and I, perched up above, whirled it around, as when a man bores ship-beams with a drill, and those below keep it in motion with a strap held by the ends, and steadily it runs. Even so we seized the fire-pointed stake and whirled it in his eye. Blood bubbled round the heated thing. The vapor singed off all the lids around the eye, and even the brows as the ball burned and its roots crackled in the flame. As when a smith dips a great axe or adze into cold water, hissing loud to temper it, for that is strength to steel, so hissed his eye about the olive stake. A hideous roar he raised. The rock resounded. We hurried away in terror. He wrenched the stake from out his eye, all dabbled with the blood, and flung it off in a frenzy. Then he called loudly on the Cyclops who dwelt about him in the caves, along the windy heights. They heard his cry and ran from every side. And standing by the cave, they asked what ailed him. "What has come on you, Polyphemus? That you scream so in the immortal night, and so keep us from sleeping? Is a man driving off your flocks in spite of you? Is a man murdering you by craft or force?" Then, in his turn from out the cave, big Polyphemus answered, "Friends, no man is murdering me by craft. Force there is none." But in answering him in winged words, they said, "If no man harms you, then, and you are alone, illness which comes from mighty Zeus you cannot fly. Nay, make your prayer to your father, Lord Poseidon." This said, they went their way, and in my heart I laughed. My name, that clever notion, so deceived them. But now the Cyclops, groaning and in agonies of anguish, by groping with his hands, took the stone off the door, yet sat himself inside the door with hands outstretched to catch whoever ventured forth among the sheep, for he probably hoped in his heart that I should be so silly. But I was planning how it all might best be ordered, that I might win escape from death, both for my men and me. So many a plot and scheme I framed, as for my life. Great danger was at hand. Then to my mind this seemed the wisest way. Some rams there were, of a good breed, thick in the fleece, handsome and large, which bore a dark blue wool. These I quietly bound together with the twisted willow withes on which the giant Cyclops slept, the brute, taking three sheep together. One in the middle carried the man. The other two walked by the sides, keeping my comrades safe. Thus three sheep bore each man. Then, for myself, there was a ram, by far the best of all the flock, whose back I grasped, and curled beneath his shaggy belly, there I lay. And with my hands twisted in that enormous fleece, I steadily held on with patient heart. Thus, then, with sighs, we awaited sacred dawn. Soon as the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, the rams hastened to pasture, but the ewes bleated unmilked about the pens, for their udders were well-nigh bursting. Their master, racked with grievous pains, felt over the backs of all the sheep as they stood up, but foolishly did not notice how under the breasts of the woolly sheep men had been fastened. Last of the flock, the ram stalked to the door, cramped by his fleece and me, the crafty plotter, and feeling him over, big Polyphemus said, "What, my pet ram, why do you move across the cave hindmost of all the flock?
Till now you never lagged behind, but with your long strides you were always first to crop the tender blooms of grass. You were the first to reach the running streams, and first to wish to turn to the stall at night. Yet here you are the last. Ah, but you miss your master's eye, which a villain has put out, he and his vile companions, blunting my wits with wine. No man it was, not, I assure him, safe from destruction. Yet, if only you could sympathize and get the power of speech to say where he is skulking from my rage, then should that brain of his be knocked about the cave and dashed upon the ground. So might my heart recover from the ills which miserable no man brought upon me. So saying, from his hand, he let the ram go forth, and after we were come a little distance from the cave and from the yard, first from beneath the ram I freed myself, and then set free my companions. So at quick pace we drove away those long-legged sheep, heavy with fat, many times turning round until we reached the ship. A welcome sight we seemed to our dear friends, as men escaped from death. Yet for the others they began to weep and wail. But this I did not suffer. By my frowns I checked their tears. Instead, I bade them straightway toss the many fleecy sheep into the ship, and sail away over the briny water. Quickly they came, took places at the pins, and, sitting in order, smote the foaming water with their oars. But when I was as far away as one can call, I shouted to the Cyclops in derision, "Cyclops! No weaklings, comrades, you were destined to devour in the deep cave with brutal might. But it was also destined your bad deeds should find you out, audacious wretch, who did not hesitate to eat the guests within your house. For this did Zeus chastise you, Zeus and the other gods." So I spoke, and he was angered in his heart the more, and tearing off the top of a high hill, he flung it at us. It fell before the dark-bowed ship a little space, but failed to reach the rudder's tip. The sea surged underneath the stone as it came down, and swiftly toward the land the wash of water swept us like a flood-tide from the deep and forced us back to shore. I seized a setting-pole and shoved the vessel off. Then, inspiriting my men, I bade them fold to their oars that we might flee from danger, with my head making signs, and, bending forward, on they rowed. When we had traversed twice the distance on the sea, again to the Cyclops would I call, but my men, gathering round, sought with soft words to stay me, each in his separate wise. O reckless man, why seek to vex this savage, who even now, hurling his missile in the deep, drove the ship back to shore? We verily thought that we were lost, and had he heard a man make but a sound or speak, he would have crushed our heads and our ship's beams by hurling jagged granite, for he can throw so far. So they spoke, but did not move my daring spirit. Again I called aloud out of an angry heart, "Cyclops, if ever mortal man asks you the story of the ugly blinding of your eye, say that Odysseus made you blind, the spoiler of cities, Laertes' son, whose home is Ithaca." So I spoke, and with a groan he answered, "Oh, surely now the ancient oracles are come upon me. Here once a prophet lived, a prophet brave and tall, Telemus, son of Eurymus, who by his prophecies obtained renown in prophetic works, grew old among the Cyclops. He told me it should come to pass in after time that I should lose my sight by means of one Odysseus. But I was always watching for the coming of some tall and comely person, arrayed in mighty power. And now a little miserable feeble creature blinded me of my eye, overcoming me with wine. Nevertheless, come here, Odysseus, and let me give the stranger's gift, and beg the famous land-shaker to aid you on your way. His son am I. He calls himself my father. He, if he will, shall heal me. None else can, whether among the blessed gods or mortal men." So he spoke, and answering him, said I,
Ah, would I might as surely strip you of life and being and send you to the house of Hades, as it is sure the earth-shaker will never heal your eye. So I spoke, whereat he prayed to Lord Poseidon, stretching his hands forth toward the starry sky.
Hear me, thou girder of the land, dark-haired Poseidon, if I am truly thine, and thou art called my father. Vouchsafe no coming home to this Odysseus, spoiler of cities, Laertes' son, whose home is Ithaca. Yet if it be his lot to see his friends once more, and reach his stately house and native land, late let him come, in evil plight, with loss of all his crew, on the vessel of a stranger, and may he at his home find trouble.
So spoke he in his prayer, and the dark-haired god gave ear. Then, once more, picking up a stone, much larger than before, the Cyclops swung and sent it, putting forth stupendous power. It fell behind the dark-bowed ship a little space, but failed to reach the rudder's tip. The sea surged underneath the stone as it came down, but the wave swept us forward and forced us to the shore. Now, when we reached the island, where our other well-benched ships waited together, while their crews sat round them, sorrowing, watching continually for us. As we ran in, we beached our ship among the sands, and forth we went ourselves upon the shore. Then, taking the Cyclops' sheep out of the hollow ship, we parted all, that none might go lacking his proper share. The ram my mailed companions gave to me alone, a mark of special honor in the division of the flock. And on the shore I offered him to Zeus of the dark cloud, the son of Cronus, who is the lord of all, burning the thighs. He did not heed the sacrifice. Instead, he purposed that my well-benched ships should all be lost and all my trusty comrades. But all throughout that day till setting sun we sat and feasted on abundant meat and pleasant wine. And when the sun went down and darkness came, we laid us down to sleep upon the beach. Then, as the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, inspiriting my men, I bade them come on board and loose the cables. Quickly they came, took places at the pins, and sitting in order smote the foaming water with their oars. Thence we sailed on, with aching hearts, glad to be clear of death, though missing our dear comrades. Book 10. Aeolus, the Laestrygonians, and Circe. Soon we drew near the island of Aeolia, where Aeolus, the son of Hippotas, dear to immortal gods, dwelt on a floating island. All round it is a wall of bronze, not to be broken through, and smooth and steep rises the rocky shore. Within the house of Aeolus 12 children have been born, 6 daughters and 6 sturdy sons. And here he gave his daughters to his sons to be their wives. Here, too, with their loved father and honored mother, they hold continual feast. Before them countless viands lie. By day the steaming house resounds even to its court. By night they sleep by their chaste wives, under the coverlets on well-bored bedsteads. Their city, it was, we reached, their goodly dwelling. For a full month here Aeolus made me welcome, and he questioned me of all, of Ilius, the Argive ships, and the return of the Achaeans. So I related all the tale in its due order. And when I furthermore asked him about my journey, and entreated him for aid, he did not say me nay, but made provision for my going. He gave me a sack, flaying therefore a 9-year ox, and in it bound the courses of the blustering winds. For the son of Cronus made him steward of the winds, to stay or rouse which one he would. Upon my hollow ship he tied the sack with a bright cord of silver, that not a breath might stir, however little. Then, for my aid, he sent the west wind forth, to blow and bear along my ships and men. But it was not to be. By our folly we were lost. 9 days we sailed, as well by night as day. Upon the 10th our native fields appeared, so close at hand that we could see men tending fires. Then sweet sleep overcame me, wearied as I was, for I had all the time managed the vessel's sheet and yielded it to no one else among the crew, that so we might the sooner reach our native land. Meanwhile, my men began to talk with one another, and to tell how I was bringing gold and silver home as gifts from Aeolus, the generous son of Hippotas. And glancing at his neighbor, one would say, "Oh, how this man is welcomed and esteemed by all mankind, come to whose town and land he may. He brings a store of goodly treasure out of the spoils of Troy, while we, who toiled along the selfsame road, come home with empty hands. Now, Aeolus gives him friendly gifts. Come, then, and let us quickly see what there is here, and how much gold and silver the sack holds." Such was their talk, and the ill counsel of the crew prevailed. They loosed the sack, and out rushed all the winds. Straightway a sweeping storm bore off to sea my weeping comrades far from their native land, and I, awaking, hesitated in my gallant heart whether to cast myself out of the ship into the sea and perish there, or, saying nothing, to endure and bide among the living. I forced myself to stay. Covering my head, I laid me down, the while the ships were driven by the cruel storm of wind back to the island of Aeolia, my comrades sighing sore. So here we went ashore and drew us water, and soon by the swift ships my men prepared a meal. Then, after we had tasted food and drink, taking a herald and a comrade with me, I turned me toward the lordly house of Aeolus. I found him at the feast beside his wife and children. We entered the hall, and on the threshold by the doorpost sat us down. And they all marveled in their hearts, and questioned, "How came you here, Odysseus? What hostile power assailed you? With care we sent you forth to let you reach your land and home, or anywhere you pleased." So they spoke, and with an aching heart I answered, "A wicked crew betrayed me, they and a cruel sleep. But heal my woes, my friends, for you have power." So I spoke, addressing them in humble words. Then all the rest were silent, but the father answered thus, "Out of the island, instantly, vilest of all that live. I may not aid or send upon his way a man detested by the blessed gods. Begone, for you are here because detested by the immortals." Therewith he turned me, loud lamenting, from his door. Thence we sailed on with aching hearts. Worn was the spirit of my men under the heavy rowing caused by our folly, too. Aid on our way appeared no more. 6 days we sailed, as well by night as day, and on the seventh came to the steep citadel of Lemus, Telepolis in Laestrygonia, where one shepherd leading home his flock calls to another, and the other answers as he leads his own flock forth. Here a man who never slept might earn a double wage. This, herding kine, that, tending silvery sheep. So close are the outgoings of the night and day. Now, when we reached the splendid harbor, round which the rock runs steep, continuous all the way, and the projecting cliffs, facing each other, stretch forward at the mouth, and narrow as the entrance, into the basin all the rest steered their curved ships, and so the ships lay in the hollow harbor, close anchored, side by side, for no wave swelled within it, large or small, but a clear calm was all around. I alone posted my black ship without the harbor, there at the point, lashing my cables to the rock. Then, climbing up, I took my stand on a rugged point of outlook. From it, no work of man or beast was to be seen, only we saw some smoke ascending from the ground. So I sent sailors forth to go and learn what men who live by bread dwelt in the land, selecting two, and joining with them a herald as a third. Leaving the ship, they took a beaten road where carts brought timber from the lofty hills down to the town below. Before the town they met a maiden drawing water, the stately daughter of the Laestrygonian Antiphates. She had come down to the clear-flowing fountain of Artesia, from which they used to fetch the water for the town. So my men, drawing near, addressed her, and inquired who was the king of the folk here, and whom he ruled. Whereat she pointed to her father's high-roofed house. But when they entered the lordly hall, they found a woman there, huge as a hilltop. At her they were aghast.
Forthwith she called from the assembly noble Antiphates, her husband, who sought to bring upon my men a miserable end. Straight seizing one, he made his meal of him, and the two others, dashing off, came flying to the ships. Thereat he raised a cry throughout the town, and hearing it, the mighty Laestrygonians gathered from here and there, seeming not men but giants. Then, from the rocks, they hurled down ponderous stones, and soon among the ships arose a dreadful din of dying men and crashing ships. As men spear fish, they gathered in their loathsome meal. But while they slaughtered these in the deep harbor, I drew my sharp sword from my thigh and cut the cables of my dark-bowed ship, and quickly inspiriting my men, I bade them fall to their oars, that we might flee from danger. They all tossed up the water in terror for their lives, and cheerily to sea, away from the beetling cliff, my ship sped on. But all the other ships went down together there. Thence we sailed on with aching hearts, glad to be clear of death, though missing our dear comrades. And now we reached the island of Eia, where fair-haired Circe dwelt, a mighty goddess, human of speech. She was own sister of the sorcerer Eetes. Both were the children of the beaming sun, and of a mother, Perse, the daughter of Oceanus. Here we bore landward with our ship, and ran in silence into a sheltering harbor, God our guide. Landing, we lay 2 days and nights, gnawing our hearts because of toil and trouble. But when the fair-haired dawn brought the third day, I took my spear and my sharp sword, and from the ship walked briskly up to a place of distant view, hoping to see some work of man or catch some voice. So, climbing up, I took my stand on a rugged point of outlook, and smoke appeared rising from open ground at Circe's dwelling, through some oak thickets and a wood. Then, for a time, I doubted in my mind and heart whether to go and search the matter while I saw the flaring smoke. Reflecting thus, it seemed the better way first to return to the swift ship and to the shore. There, give my men their dinner, and send them forth to search. But on my way, as I drew near to the curved ship, some god took pity on me all forlorn, and sent a high-horned deer into my very path. From feeding in the wood he came to the stream to drink, for the sun's power oppressed him. As he stepped out, I struck him in the spine, midway along the back. The bronze spear pierced him through. Down in the dust he fell with a moan, and his life flew away. Setting my foot upon him, I drew from the wound the brazen spear and laid it on the ground. Then I plucked twigs and osiers, and wove a rope a fathom long, twisted from end to end, with which I bound together the monstrous creature's legs. So, with him upon my back, I walked to the black ship, leaning upon my spear, because it was not possible to hold him with my hand upon my shoulder, for the beast was very large. Before the ship I threw him down, and then with cheering words aroused my men, standing by each in turn. "We shall not, friends, however sad, go to the halls of Hades until our destined day. But while there still is food and drink in the swift ship, let us attend to eating, not waste away with hunger." So I spoke, and my words they quickly heeded. Throwing their coverings off upon the shore beside the barren sea, they gazed upon the deer, for the beast was very large. Then, after they had satisfied their eyes with gazing, they washed their hands and made a glorious feast. Thus, all throughout the day till setting sun, we sat and feasted on abundant meat and pleasant wine. And when the sun went down and darkness came, we laid us down to sleep upon the beach. Then, as the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, holding a council, I said to all my men, "My suffering comrades, hearken to my words. For since, my friends, we do not know the place of dusk or dawn, the place at which the beaming sun goes underground, nor where he rises, let us at once consider if a wise course be left. I do not think there is, for I saw, on climbing to a rugged outlook, an island which the boundless deep encircles like a crown. Low in the sea it lies. Midway across I saw a smoke through some oak thickets and a wood." As I thus spoke, their very souls were crushed within them,
remembering the deeds of the Lestragonian Antiphates, and the cruelty of the daring Cyclops, the devourer of men. They cried aloud and let the big tears fall, but no good came to them from their lamenting. Now the whole body of my mailed companions I told off in two bands, and to each band assigned a leader. The one I led, godlike Eurylochus the other. Straightway we shook the lots in a bronze helmet, and the lot of bold Eurylochus leapt out the first. So he departed, 22 comrades following, all in tears, and us they left in sorrow too behind. Within the glades they found the house of Circe, built of smooth stone upon commanding ground. All round about were mountain wolves and lions, which Circe had charmed by giving them evil drugs. These creatures did not spring upon my men, but stood erect, wagging their long tails, fawning, as hounds fawn round their master when he comes from meat, because he always brings them dainties that they like. So round these men the strong-clawed wolves and lions fawned. Still my men trembled at the sight of the strange beasts. They stood before the door of the fair-haired goddess, and in the house heard Circe singing with sweet voice, while tending her great imperishable loom, and weaving webs fine, beautiful, and lustrous as are the works of gods. Polites was the first to speak, one ever foremost, and one to me the nearest and the dearest of my comrades. Ah, friends, somebody in the house is tending a great loom and singing sweetly. All the pavement rings. A god it is, or a woman. Then let us quickly call. He spoke. The others lifted up their voice and called, and suddenly coming forth, she opened the shining doors and bade them in. The rest all followed, heedless. Only Eurylochus remained behind, suspicious of a snare. She led them in and seated them on couches and on chairs, and made a potion for them. Cheese, barley, and yellow honey stirred into Pramnian wine, but mingled with the food pernicious drugs to make them quite forget their native land. Now, after she had given the cup, and they had drunk it off, straight with a wand she smote them, and penned them up in styes. And they took on the heads of swine, the voice, the bristles, and even the shape, yet was their reason as sound as heretofore. Thus, weeping, they were penned, and Circe flung them acorns, chestnuts, and cornel fruit to eat, such things as swine that wallow in the mire are wont to eat. Eurylochus, meanwhile, came to the swift black ship to bring me tidings of my men and tell their bitter fate. Strive as he might, he could not speak a word, so stricken was he to the soul with sore distress. His eyes were filled with tears, his heart felt anguish. But when we all, in great amazement, questioned him, then he described the loss of all his men. We went, as you commanded, noble Odysseus, through the thicket, and found within the glades a beautiful house built of smooth stone upon commanding ground. There somebody was tending a great loom and loudly singing, some god or woman. The others lifted up their voice and called, and suddenly, coming forth, she opened the shining doors and bade them in. The rest all followed, heedless, but I remained behind, suspicious of a snare. They vanished, one and all. Not one appeared again, though long I sat and watched. So he spoke. I slung my silver-studded sword about my shoulders, large it was, and made of bronze, and my bow with it, and bade him lead me back the selfsame way. But he, clasping my knees with both his hands, entreated me, and sorrowfully said in winged words, O heaven-descended man, bring me not there against my will, but leave me here. For well I know you never will return, nor will you bring another of your comrades. Rather, with these now here let us speed on, for we might even yet escape the evil day. So he spoke, and answering him, said I, Eurylochus, remain then here yourself, eating and drinking by the black hollow ship. But I will go, for strong necessity is on me. Saying this, I passed up from the ship and from the sea. But when, in walking up the solemn glades, I was about to reach the great house of the sorceress Circe, there I was met, as I approached the house, by Hermes of the golden wand, in likeness of a youth, the first down on his lip, a time of life most pleasing. He held my hand and spoke, and thus addressed me. Where are you going, hapless man, along the hills alone, ignorant of the land? Your comrades yonder, at the house of Circe, are penned like swine and kept in fast-closed sties. You come to free them? Nay, I am sure you will return no more, but there, like all the rest, you too will stay. Still, I can keep you clear of harm and give you safety. Here, take this potent herb and go to Circe's house. This shall protect your life against the evil day. And I will tell you all the magic arts of Circe. She will prepare for you a potion and cast drugs into your food. But even so, she cannot charm you, because the potent herb which I shall give will not permit it. And let me tell you more. When Circe turns against you her long wand, then, drawing the sharp sword from your thigh, spring upon Circe as if you meant to slay her. In terror she will bid you to her bower. And do not you refuse the goddess's bower, that so she may release your men and care for you. But bid her swear the Blessed One's great oath that she is not meaning now to plot you a fresh woe, and when you are defenseless make you feeble and unmanned. As thus he spoke, the speedy comer gave the herb, drawing it from the ground, and pointed out its nature. Black at the root it is, like milk in its blossom, and the gods call it moly. Hard is it for a mortal man to dig. With gods, all things may be. Hermes departed now to high Olympus along the woody island. I made my way to Circe's house, and as I went, my heart grew very dark. But I stood at the gate of the fair-haired goddess, stood there and called, and the goddess heard my voice. Suddenly, coming forth, she opened the shining doors and bade me in. I followed her with aching heart. She led me in and placed me on a silver-studded chair, beautiful, richly wrought, with a footstool for the feet. And she prepared a potion in a golden cup for me to drink, but put therein a drug with wicked purpose in her heart. Now, after she had given the drink, and I had drunk it off, and yet it had not charmed me, smiting me with her wand, she spoke these words, and cried, "Off to the sty, and lie there with your fellows!" She spoke. I drew the sharp blade from my thigh, and sprang upon Circe, as if I meant to slay her. With a loud cry she cowered, and clasped my knees, and sorrowfully said in winged words, "Who are you? Of what people? Where is your town and kindred? I marvel much that, drinking of these drugs, you were not charmed. None, no man else, ever withstood these drugs who tasted them, so soon as they had passed the barrier of his teeth. But in your breast there is a mind which cannot be beguiled. Surely you are adventurous Odysseus, who, the god of the golden wand, the speedy comer, always declared would come upon his way from Troy, he and his swift black ship. Nay, then, put up your blade within its sheath, and let us now turn to my bower, that there we too may know our love and learn to trust each other." So she spoke, and answering her, said I, "Circe, why ask me to be gentle toward you, when you have turned my comrades into swine within your halls, and here detain me, and with treacherous purpose invite me to your bower, and to approach your side, that when I am defenseless you will make me feeble and unmanned? But I will never willingly approach your bower till you consent, goddess, to swear a solemn oath that you are not meaning now to plot me a new woe." So I spoke. And she then took the oath which I required. So after she had sworn and ended all that oath, then I approached the beauteous bower of Circe. Meanwhile, attendants plied their work about the halls, four maids who were the serving women of the palace. They are the children of the springs and groves and of the sacred streams that run into the sea. One threw upon the chairs beautiful cloths. Purple she spread above, linen below. The next placed silver tables by the chairs, and set forth golden baskets. A third stirred in a bowl the cheering wine, sweet wine in silver, and filled the golden cups. A fourth brought water and kindled a large fire under a great kettle, and let the water warm. Then, when the water in the glittering copper boiled, she seated me in the bath and bathed me from the kettle about the head and shoulders, tempering the water well, till from my joints she drew the sore fatigue. And after she had bathed me and anointed me with oil, and put upon me a goodly coat and tunic, she led me in and placed me on a silver-studded chair, beautiful, richly wrought, with a footstool for the feet, and water for the hands a servant brought me, in a beautiful pitcher made of gold, and poured it out over a silver basin for my washing, and spread a polished table by my side. Then the grave housekeeper brought bread and placed before me, setting out food of many a kind, freely giving of her store, and bade me eat. But that pleased not my heart. I sat with other thoughts. My heart foreboded evil. When Circe marked me sitting thus, not laying hands upon my food, but cherishing sore sorrow, approaching me, she said in winged words, "Why do you sit, Odysseus, thus, like one struck dumb, gnawing your heart, and touch no food nor drink? Do you suspect some further guile? You have no cause for fear, for even now I swore to you a solemn oath." So she spoke, and answering her, said I, "Ah, Circe, what upright man could bring himself to taste of food or drink before he had released his friends and seen them with his eyes? But if you, in sincerity, will bid me drink and eat, then set them free, that I with my own eyes may see my trusty comrades." So I spoke, and from the hall went Circe, wand in hand. She opened the sty doors, and forth she drove what seemed like 9-year swine. A while they stood before her, and, passing along the line, Circe anointed each one with a counter-charm. So from their members fell the hair which at first the accursed drug, which potent Circe gave, had made to grow. And once more they were men. Men younger than before, much fairer, too, and taller to behold. They knew me, and each grasped my hand, and from them all passionate sobs burst forth, and all the house gave a sad echo. The goddess pitied us, even she, and standing by my side the heavenly goddess said, "High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, go now to your swift ship and to the shore, and first of all, draw up your ship upon the land, and store within the caves your goods and all your gear. Then come back yourself and bring your trusty comrades." So she spoke, and my high heart assented. I went to the swift ship and to the shore, and found by the swift ship my trusty comrades in bitter lamentation, letting the big tears fall. As the stalled calves skip round a drove of cows returning to the barnyard when satisfied with grazing, with one accord they all bound forth, the folds no longer hold them, but with continual bleat they frisk about their mothers, so did these men, when they caught sight of me, press weeping round. To them it seemed as if they had already reached their land, their very town of rugged Ithaca, where they were bred and born. And through their sobs they said in winged words, "Now you have come, O heaven-descended man. We are as glad as if we were approaching Ithaca, our native land. But tell about the loss of all our other comrades." So they spoke. I, in soft words, made answer, "Let us now first of all draw up our ship upon the land, and store within the caves our goods and all our gear. Then hasten, all of you, to follow me, and see your comrades in the magic house of Circe, drinking and eating, holding constant cheer." So I spoke, and my words they quickly heeded. Eurylochus alone tried to hold back my comrades, and speaking in winged words he said, "Poor fools, where are we going? Why are you so in love with ill that you will go to Circe's hall and let her turn us all to swine and wolves and lions, that we may then keep watch at her great house perforce? Such deeds the Cyclops did when to his lair our comrades came, and with them went this reckless man Odysseus, for through his folly those men also perished." As thus he spoke, I hesitated in my heart whether to draw my keen-edged blade from my stout thigh and by a blow bring down his head into the dust, near as he was by tie of marriage. But with soft words my comrades stayed me, each in his separate wise. High-born Odysseus, we will leave him, if you like, here by the ship to guard the ship. But lead us to the magic house of Circe. Saying this, they passed up from the ship and from the sea. Yet did Eurylochus not tarry by the hollow ship? He followed, for he feared my stern rebuke. But in the meanwhile, to my other comrades at the palace, Circe had given a pleasant bath, anointed them with oil, and put upon them fleecy coats and tunics. Merrily feasting in her halls, we found them all. When the men saw and recognized each other, they wept aloud, and the house rang around, and standing by my side, the heavenly goddess said, High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, let not this swelling grief rise further now. I myself know what hardships you have borne upon the swarming sea, and how fierce men harassed you on the land. Come then, eat food, drink wine, until you find once more that spirit in the breast which once was yours when you first left your native land of rugged Ithaca. Now, worn and spiritless, your thoughts still dwell upon your weary wandering. This many a day your heart has not been glad, for sorely have you suffered. So she spoke, and our high hearts assented. Here, then, day after day, for a full year, we sat and feasted on abundant meat and pleasant wine. But when the year was gone, and the round of the seasons rolled, as the months waned and the long days were done, then, calling me aside, my trusty comrade said, Ah, sir, consider now your native land, if you are destined ever to be saved and reach your stately house and native land. So they spoke, and my high heart assented. Yet all throughout that day, till setting sun, we sat and feasted on abundant meat and pleasant wine. And when the sun went down, and darkness came, my men lay down to sleep throughout the dusky halls. But I, on coming to the beauteous bower of Circe, made supplication to her by her knees, and to my voice the goddess hearkened. And speaking in winged words, I said, Circe, fulfill the promise made to send me home, for now my spirit stirs with that of all my men who vex my heart with their complaints when you are gone away. So I spoke, and straight the heavenly goddess answered, High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, stay no longer at my home against your will, but you must first perform a different journey, and go to the hall of Hades and of dread Persephone, there to consult the spirit of Tiresias of Thebes, the prophet blind whose mind is steadfast still. To him, though dead, Persephone has granted reason, to him alone sound understanding. The rest are flitting shadows. As she thus spoke, my very soul was crushed within me, and sitting on the bed I fell to weeping. My heart no longer cared to live and see the sun. But when, of weeping and of writhing, I had had my fill, then thus I answered her and said, But Circe, who will be my pilot on this journey? None by black ship has ever reached the land of Hades. So I spoke, and straight the heavenly goddess answered, High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, let not the lack of pilot for your ship disturb you, but set the mast, spread the white sail aloft, and sit you down. The breath of Boreas shall bear her onward. When you have crossed by ship the ocean stream to where the shore is rough and the grove of Persephone stands, tall poplars and seed-shedding willows, there, beach your ship by the deep eddies of the ocean stream, but go yourself to the moldering house of Hades. There is a spot where into Acheron run Pyriphlegethon and Cocytus, a stream which is an offshoot of the waters of the Styx. A rock here forms the meeting point of the two roaring rivers. To this spot, then, hero, draw nigh, even as I bid, and dig a pit, about a cubit either way, and round its edges pour an offering to all the dead. First, honey mixture, next, sweet wine, and thirdly, water, and over all strew the white barley meal. Make many supplications also to the strengthless dead, vowing, when you return to Ithaca, to take the barren cow that is your best and offer it in your hall, heaping the pyre with treasure. And to Tiresias, separately, to sacrifice a sheep, for him alone, one holy black, the very choicest of your flock. So, when with vows you have implored the illustrious peoples of the dead, offer a ram and a black ewe, bending their heads toward Erebus. But turn yourself away, facing the river stream. To you shall gather many spirits of those now dead and gone. Then forthwith call your men, and bid them take the sheep now lying there slain by the ruthless sword, and flay and burn them, and call upon the gods, on powerful Hades and on dread Persephone. While you yourself, drawing your sharp sword from your thigh, sit still, and do not let the strengthless dead approach the blood till you have made inquiry of Tiresias. Thither the seer will quickly come, O chief of men, and he will tell your course, the stages of your journey, and of your homeward way, how you may pass along the swarming sea. Even as she spoke, the gold-throned morning came. On me she put a coat and tunic for my raiment, and the nymph dressed herself in a long silvery robe, fine-spun and graceful. She bound a beautiful golden girdle round her waist, and put a veil upon her head. Then through the house I passed, and roused my men with cheering words, standing by each in turn. Sleep no more, nor drowse in pleasant slumber, but let us go, for potent Circe has at last made known the way. So I spoke, and their high hearts assented. Yet even from there I did not bring away my men in safety. There was a certain Alpinar, the youngest of them all, a man not very firm in fight nor sound of understanding, who, parted from his mates, lay down to sleep upon the magic house of Circe, seeking for coolness when overcome with wine. As his companions stirred, hearing the noise and tumult, he suddenly sprang up and quite forgot how to come down again by the long ladder, but fell headlong from the roof. His neck was broken in its socket, and his soul went down to the house of Hades. As my men mustered there, I said to them, "You think perhaps that you are going home to your own native land. But Circe has marked out for us a different journey, even to the halls of Hades and of dread Persephone, there to consult the spirit of Tiresias of Thebes." As thus I spoke, their very souls were crushed within them, and sitting down where each one was, they moaned and tore their hair, but no good came to them from their lamenting. Now, while we walked to the swift ship and to the shore in sadness, letting the big tears fall, Circe went on before, and there by the black ship tied a black ewe and ram, passing us lightly by. When a god does not will, what man can spy him moving to and fro? Book 11. The Land of the Dead. Now when we came down to the ship and to the sea, we, in the first place, launched our ship into the sacred sea, put mast and sail in the black ship, then took the sheep and drove them in. And we ourselves embarked in sadness, letting the big tears fall. And for our aid, behind our dark-bowed ship, came a fair wind to fill our sail, a welcome comrade sent us by fair-haired Circe, the mighty goddess, human of speech. So when we'd done our work at several ropes about the ship, we sat us down, while wind and helmsman kept her steady. And all day long the sail of the running ship was stretched. Then the sun sank, and all the ways grew dark. And now she reached Earth's limits, the deep stream of the ocean, where the Cimmerian people's land and city lie, wrapped in a fog and cloud. Never on them does the shining sun look down with his beams, as he goes up the starry sky, or as again toward Earth he turns back from the sky, but deadly night is spread abroad over these hapless men. On coming here, we beached our ship and set the sheep ashore, then walked along the ocean stream until we reached the spot foretold by Circe. Here Perimedes and Eurylochus held fast the victims, while drawing my sharp blade from my thigh, I dug a pit, about a cubit either way, and round its edges poured an offering to all the dead,
first honey mixture, next sweet wine, and thirdly water, and over all I strewed white barley meal. And I made many supplications to the strengthless dead, vowing, when I returned to Ithaca, to take the barren cow that was my best and offer it in my hall, heaping the pyre with treasure, and to Tiresias separately to sacrifice a sheep for him alone, one holy black, the choicest of my flock. So when with prayers and vows I had implored the peoples of the dead, I took the sheep and cut their throats over the pit, and forth the dark blood flowed. Then gathered their spirits from out of Erebus, of those now dead and gone, brides and unwedded youths, and worn old men, delicate maids with hearts but new to sorrow, and many pierced with brazen spears, men slain in fight, wearing their blood-stained armor. In crowds around the pit they flocked from every side, with awful wail. Pale terror seized me. Nevertheless, inspiriting my men, I bade them take the sheep now lying there slain by the ruthless sword, and flay and burn them, and call upon the gods, on powerful Hades, and on dread Persephone, while I myself, drawing my sharp sword from my thigh, sat still and did not let the strengthless dead approach the blood, till I had made inquiry of Tiresias. First came the spirit of my man Elpenor. He had not yet been buried under the broad earth, for we left his body at the hall of Circe, unwept, unburied, since another task then pressed. I wept to see him, and pitied him from my heart, and speaking in winged words, I said, "Elpenor, how came you in this murky gloom? Faster you came on foot than I in my black ship." So I spoke, and with a groan he answered, "High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, heaven's cruel doom destroyed me, and excess of wine. After I went to sleep on Circe's house, I did not notice how to go down again by the long ladder, but fell headlong from the roof. My neck was broken in its socket, and my soul came down to the house of Hades. Now I entreat you, by those left behind, not present here, by your wife, and by the father who cared for you when little, and by Telemachus, whom you left at home alone. For I know, as you go hence out of the house of Hades, you will touch with your staunch ship the island of Aeaea. There then, my master, I charge you, think of me. Do not, in going, leave me behind, unwept, unburied, deserting me, lest I become a cause of anger to the gods against you. But burn me in the armor that was mine, and on the shore of the foaming sea erect the mound of an unhappy man, that future times may know. Do this for me, and fix upon my grave the oar with which in life I rode among my comrades." So he spoke, and answering him, said I, "Unhappy man, this will I carry out and do for you." In such sad words, talking with one another, there we sat, I on the one side, holding my blade over the blood, while the spectre of my comrade on the other told of his many woes. Now came the spirit of my dead mother, Anticlia, daughter of brave Autolycus, whom I had left alive on setting forth for sacred Ilius. I wept to see her and pitied her from my heart, but even so I did not let her, deeply though it grieved me, approach the blood, till I had made inquiry of Tiresias. Now came the spirit of Tiresias of Thebes, holding his golden scepter. He knew me, and said to me, "High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, why now, unhappy man, leaving the sunshine, have you come here to see the dead and this forbidding place? Nay, draw back from the pit and turn your sharp blade from the blood, that I may drink and speak what will not fail." So he spoke, and drawing back I thrust my silver-studded sword into its sheath. And after he had drunk of the dark blood, then thus the blameless seer addressed me, "You are looking for a joyous journey home, glorious Odysseus, but a god will make it hard, for I do not think you will elude the land-shaker, who bears a grudge against you in his heart, angry because you blinded his dear son. Yet, even so, by meeting hardship, you may still reach home.
if you will curb the passions of yourself and crew, when once you bring your staunch ship to the Thrinacian island, safe from the dark blue sea, and find the pasturing kine and sturdy sheep of the sun, who all things oversees, all overhears. If you leave these unharmed, and heed your homeward way, you still may come to Ithaca, though you shall meet with hardship. But if you harm them, then I predict the loss of ship and crew. And even if you yourself escape, late shall you come, in evil plight, with loss of all your crew, on the vessel of a stranger. At home you shall find trouble, bold men devouring your living, wooing your matchless wife, and offering bridal gifts. Nevertheless, on your return, you surely shall avenge their crimes. But after you have slain the suitors in your halls, whether by stratagem or by sharp sword boldly, then journey on, bearing a shapely oar, until you reach the men who know no sea and do not eat food mixed with salt. These, therefore, have no knowledge of the red-cheeked ships, nor of the shapely oars which are the wings of ships. And I will name a sign easy to be observed, which shall not fail you. When another traveller, meeting you, shall say you have a winnowing fan on your white shoulder, there fix in the ground your shapely oar, and make fit offerings to Lord Poseidon, a ram, a bull, and the sow's mate, a boar, and turning homeward, offer sacred hecatombs to the immortal gods who hold the open sky, all in the order due. Upon yourself, death from the sea shall very gently come and cut you off, bowed down with hale old age. Round you shall be a prosperous people. I speak what shall not fail. So he spoke, and answering him, said I, Tiresias, these are the threads of destiny the gods themselves have spun. Nevertheless, declare me this, and plainly tell. I see the spirit of my dead mother here. Silent she sits beside the blood, and has not, although I am her son, deigned to look in my face or speak to me. Tell me, my master, how may she know that it is I? So I spoke, and straightway answering me, said he, A simple saying I will tell, and fix it in your mind. Whomever among these dead and gone you let approach the blood, he shall declare the truth. But whomsoever you refuse, he shall turn back again. So saying, into the house of Hades passed the spirit of the great Tiresias, after telling heaven's decrees. But I still held my place until my mother came and drank of the dark blood. She knew me instantly, and sorrowfully said in winged words, My child, how came you in this murky gloom while still alive? Awful to the living are these sights,